to another episode of ERA Talks. I am Stephanie Tierney, the Membership Director and Podcast Coordinator here at ERA. Today's topic is the academic view of the rep model. We are very excited for our guest, Dr. George John, Professor and General Mills Giroux, Chair in Marketing for the Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota. We also thank Michael Swenson of Mel Foster Company for introducing him to us. This is going to be a great topic. Welcome, Dr. John.
Thank you.
I am now going to turn this over to ERA's CEO, Walter Tobin, for hosting this episode.
Thanks, Stephanie. Welcome, Dr. John. ERA is delighted to have you on our latest podcast. It is great to get a view that we hardly ever get to see from a senior academic from a prestigious university who studies sales and is somewhat an expert on different sales models, particularly the rep sales model. My first question, Dr. John, is what drove you to study the rep sales model and how has this driven the curriculum in the Carlson School of Management?
Well, that's a great question, Walt. In my PhD days at Northwestern, my advisor was into channels. And I quickly realized that sales and channels were inextricably linked. My research career has sort of always been at the intersection of sales and channels. And as it turns out, that's a huge part of the economy. So just to put it in perspective, in the economy, we all think that advertising is probably the most visible part of marketing. But the non-advertising expenditures in marketing, which is basically sales, is about three times the size of advertising. So if you think Google and Facebook are big companies, there's three times that kind of monetization of dollars being spent in sales. So it's an exciting area. It's a lot of unexplored work, and it's a place where a lot of different research comes together.
And how has this trickled down, Dr. John, into the curriculum in the Carlson School of Management? What impact has this had on you setting the curriculum for your students?
Well, I have to confess, that's probably the place where we've fallen down the most. Even though sales is so important to the economy and channels, I'm going to use those two words together. If you look at the typical undergraduate business program or an MBA program, it's the representation of sales and channels classes have actually been decreasing. And I think that's you know, physician, heal thyself. We haven't done a good job of marketing our own stuff. So I think what you're seeing is a generation of folks coming out of school who are not as well versed in these topics as they might have been 25, 30 years ago.
Yes, that's an excellent point. We see that every day in our lives, which leads me to my next question is the folks coming out of school in many cases end up as C-level managers within their companies. In some cases, they may have little, if any, understanding of the channel structure. What's been your experience in dealing with these C-level managers and their thoughts on different sales channels, particularly the rep model?
Let's call it as a combination of fear and loathing. They know they need third-party help, but they also are afraid of becoming reliant on third-party help. So I think there's this constant balancing act compounded by the problem that they normally don't have enough experience dealing with folks who are independent of them. We're not somebody's employee. So you can tell your employees to do X or Y, but it's hard to tell a third-party sales firm or an independent distributor exactly what to do unless you provide them with incentives. So it's a different mindset, and a lot of them have trouble navigating that multi-firm mindset needed to be successful in a sales and channels context, especially in a B2B world.
And in your discussions with them, have you been able to, you know, move them off of thinking as the independent sales channel as an expense versus an investment in their, in fact, this is their sales force?
Yes, with given enough face time, yes. So here's the fundamental issue. We've had sort of two tsunami events, and I'm going to put COVID to the side. The other tsunami over the last 15 years has been everything's gone digital. So your typical company thinks, aha, digital means it's going to be cheaper. I can cut out the middleman, quote unquote. And therefore, their worldview is predicated on the notion that it's a substitute for the other thing. And I really try to emphasize to them, here's where advertising and sales diverges. If you look at what happened to the digitization of advertising, Google and Facebook own about 50% of that, and they're about 99% of their revenues from advertising. It's basically substituted for yellow pages and newspaper advertising. But if you look at the research and sales, it's abundantly clear it's not a substitute. It's actually a complement. Every company that I know of that has added a digital channel where they didn't have one, or added a traditional channel where they only had a digital channel, provided they've managed the complementarities, what you see is overall sales increasing. So sales across the digital and non-digital domains are complementary. Advertising is substitutable. That's good news for us who are in sales and channels.
It's a great point. All of us have gotten used to instant gratification of information. We want an answer right now. We don't want to wait an hour, a minute, a week, or for somebody to come by. And a lot of that has been available on the internet. And to combine the digital world with the distributor model or the rep model seems to be the best benefit. What do you see in the result of COVID hitting the first, second week of March? How do you see that playing now in balancing the digital world versus the world today in which nobody can see anybody? Customers are not open. Travel is pretty much ground to zero. How do you see that relating to the digital world and the blending of the channel and the rep model?
So I'm going to rely on intuition and long-run research findings. I'm not going to rely on the current data because, to use a statistical term, this is out of sample experience. We've never experienced anything like this. So I just don't know which part of what's happening today will stay the way it is, and which part of what we're happening today will snap back. We just don't know. What I would urge everybody out there trying to make a living is that you need to be adaptive. You need to get through this period where a liquidity issue does not become a sustainability issue, to use a finance term. If you're out of business, you're out of business. So you need to make it through this. But the point is, what are the long-term lessons about digitization coming in? There, it's a lot more interesting because we know certain truths. So I want to leave you with at least two important points. First, whether it's COVID now, today, or after COVID, the fracturing of the customer journey has happened. What am I talking about? Every customer, whether it's a simple grocery store customer going to the grocery store to pick something up, or whether it's somebody who wants an electrical component designed in, goes through what we call an omni-channel journey. What does that mean? They start with one touch point, perhaps a sales rep, perhaps a company website. They jump to something else. They jump back. That's a given. That particular fracturing of the customer journey is what makes the complementarity between channels so important, because you have to be prepared to meet the customer where they go next. It may not be you. It may be handed off to somebody else, but those handoffs have to be done properly. So that's the big lesson: coordination, complementarity, and meeting the customer where the customer is, not trying to, quote, direct the customer toward us.
So there's a saying, you want to skate where the puck is going, and you being a fine University of Minnesota person can relate to that.
I believe Gretzky said, you want to be where the puck is going to be.
Right. That's right. So I think what we're dealing with today is to try to have all of us transition to go from a world in which we're all comfortable being out in front of the customer to a world now dealing with the customer in a virtual world or a video world. What do you see as some of the challenges or opportunities, frankly, with the sales force now having to deal with an in-person visit now being more of a video call?
Yes.
Which may in fact be the same thing.
So let's talk about the opportunity. One of the things that's a little bit underappreciated is that you actually, as a salesperson, actually have more ability to contact a much greater variety of people in an organization than you ever had. People are accustomed to seeing stuff on video. They're accustomed to downloading a short video presentation. You'd be amazed at how many people in the C-suite actually go and check out the short videos on new products and stuff like that. So I'd urge every rep firm out there to make sure that no matter which way the customer comes in, they've got an entry point into your organization. You cannot wait for the traditional. When I started out in this business, the people in the office would give me my little pink slip of the front end of the day and say, oh, so-and-so called, will you call back? That's all gone, and we're used to handling our own phone calls now. But in an aggregate sense, that's also true of sales. So that's the opportunity. You can actually reach people you couldn't reach before. Now, that doesn't mean it's easy, because trying to cut a 3-minute video for somebody sitting as a design engineer in a lab is not the same as trying to convince a customer who's worried about the percentage discount. So you have to be very sensitive to what the customer needs are. You have to be very sensitive to who's likely to look at it. The good thing is the technology lets you quickly figure out who's doing what and who's looking at your videos, who's downloaded it, what kind of asynchronous things can be set up, what kind of synchronous things can be set up, all of those kinds of things. The difficulty is exactly the same as the opportunity. The difficulty is that sometimes they want an instant read from the company equivalent of your rep. And, you know, companies have protocols and policies, most of which have to do with giving up part of the commission, and everybody fights over where that lead came from. We've got to get out of that mentality, because that gets in the way of the coordination and complementarity that I'm talking about.
But Dr. John, I love the comment about the reps being really close to the customer and getting audiences. What do you see as some of the benefits of the rep model regarding A, being, you know, in the territory all the time? That, you know, a rep has a geographic territory, so they're not moving from Minnesota to Boston. They're there all the time. They've been there 15, 20 years. And then secondly, the ability to have multiple complementary lines, complementary technology to get different audiences with the purchasing or engineering people. Do you see that as being an advantage for the rep model, either today or through certainly the times of COVID?
Absolutely. Let me just put that in slightly more abstract academic terms. So, you know, what does a rep bring to the table? It is the fact that their customer is truly their customer. The principal that they represent is only the person that makes them valuable to the customer. It's a two-way street. They're valuable to the principal because they have the trust and confidence of the customer, which means that the third-party nature of a rep is well aligned with developing this kind of insight, because, as you pointed out, which comes as a surprise to a lot of people, that reps have much longer face-to-face histories with particular clients. They know which clients are growing and which clients are moving in what direction. And there's a very simple reason for that. Think about the young sales guy in a company sales organization. What is he or she trying to do? They're trying to move up the organization. How do you get promoted? Well, you're good at sales and you get promoted. That means you don't see that client anymore. One research study we did showed that the average company salesperson sees a given client less than a year if they're successful. The successful ones move on. You contrast that to the successful manufacturer's rep. They've seen these guys for years. They've, you know, been to their kids' hockey games. They know them socially. They know them professionally. And it's a much closer, deeper relationship. That's number one. The other piece that I really want to point out is that the incentive responsiveness of a third-party agent is much higher than an employee, for precisely the same reasons that I just mentioned before. So if I were to up my commission by 10%, I meaning the principal, a rep's response is far higher than if I were to offer that same 10% incentive pay increase to an internal employee. Why? Because an internal employee is just as much motivated by promotion possibilities as current pay. Not so for the rep. That makes the rep model very well aligned with two things: getting better input about what customers want. Number two, they're much more responsive to incentives, so it's a cheaper, more efficient way of doing business. And number three, they are vendor neutral in the sense that they can sell complementary items, hammers and nails, if you will, without worrying about, oh, you know, I'm not being loyal to my company and trying to stuff my company's products, the full breadth of it, onto a particular client.
Boy, great point. Some of the challenges that we see in the industry is for the rep model, the rep network, to convince the manufacturers that they are, in fact, part of the company. They are part of the sale. They are the sales force. They're part of the company versus this at arm's reach group of hired guns, if you will. What would be some of the suggestions you might have that the rep industry can convince the C-level people that the reps are not an expense, they're an investment, they are part of your sales team, and they should not worry about not having direct control? In many cases, they probably have more control over the rep, as you just pointed out. What kind of guidance could you give our listeners on driving that point home with their manufacturers?
You know, it's repetition, 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 honestly, because managers come and go. You almost have to break in the new managers every 2 years. And that's true at mid-level. That's true at the upper levels. It's difficult to understand sometimes how rapidly people turn over in the sales organization in large corporations. You get mergers, you get acquisitions, you get transfers, you get promotions. So part of the challenge is just constantly I don't want to use the phrase re-education. That sounds like some horrible propaganda mission. But honestly, it's a case of getting them familiar, reminding them, I'm the constant presence of the customer. Let me show you what this customer does, what the customer wants. And in some sense, being willing to trust the company a little bit more, even if you think sometimes you're not going to get paid for the level of input you gave them. But that's a good way to build trust. It's more difficult for the company guy who's new to trust you than for you to trust the company, because the company is, you've always been dealing with the same company. It's a new person within the company. So the onus is really on the rep firm to constantly refresh the memory, if you will, that the firm has of its customers.
Boy, that's great. Great points. We're going to keep reselling. And you're right. The VP of sales or the sales director, you know, they change every 2-3 years. Yes. And we have to make sure that we keep fine-tuning our game. The question on COVID has changed the world, certainly changed the world of face-to-face selling. How do you see that affecting the world of selling and it moving forward? And what do you see as some of the change, or what we call the new abnormal, after COVID is less of an issue, perhaps after a vaccine? What do you think the new abnormal is going to look like, Dr. John?
Right. So I think I'll offer a short-term and a long-term perspective. In the short term, it is absolutely vital you keep your cash flow coming in. How do you do that? Right now, given the sort of the chaos, your best bet is to try and maintain your presence with your existing customer base. Make sure you don't lose your share of wallet with the existing customer base, because the existing customer base is far easier to keep than it is to go out and get a new customer in this environment. That's number one. That's short term. That's just survival mode. It's easy for me to say. It's hard for you guys to execute that. But it's imperative you keep your share of wallet of existing customers. In the longer run, I think what you want to do is to be prepared to actually not do some of the things you're doing now, because I think it's important to recognize it is an abnormal period. So you need to be flexible. You need to be careful about which pieces you want to keep and which pieces you can replace it being more effective. It's tempting to think, for example, oh, travel is horrendously expensive and we've been doing fine with much less travel or zero travel, not realizing that much more of your sales are coming from existing clients. So you have to be careful about that. I think the danger is that we always react to what's in front of us and not to what's coming up into the future. So I think what you need to do is to think hard about what lessons have we learned from this that we can keep, but not keep everything in place because it looks cheaper or it worked in the short run.
Boy, that's great advice, Doctor. Some of us are waiting for the old days to come back. And I think your advice is the old days are gone.
Yes.
And keep fine-tuning your skill set and make sure that you can a skate where the puck is going to be.
Yes.
I like that term. As a sales expert, if you will, what final advice can you give our listeners? You know, we have reps on the, listen to these. We have distributors, we have manufacturers. We've got all three legs on the stool. What sort of advice or guidance can you give us, or maybe a peek into the, into your crystal ball for 2021?
Right. So every person I speak to in the distribution world or the sales world talks about Amazon business. The idea that Amazon's going to roll up the B2B space the way they've rolled up the B2C space. I think the lessons and the messages that are thrown around miss the mark. I think what's going to happen is an extension of what's been happening over the last 15 years. I called it the fracturing of the customer journey. That's here to stay. That's totally here to stay. So what does that mean for you folks? You guys have been dealing with this for about 15 years already. So you sort of know what a fractured customer journey means. You put in a lot of investment into a sale, and sometimes you don't get that sale because they decide they can get a lower unit price somewhere else. That's going to happen. That's not going to not happen. But you've got to learn to find creative ways of dealing with that. The good news is that overall, it's complementary, not a substitute, the way advertising has been. So that's one thing. The fracturing of the customer journey is here to stay. The second thing is that we have so much more data. We need to exploit that data in a more strategic way, especially in the way of getting paid for what you did, in the way of better fine-tuned incentive programs. For example, today, you could easily set up incentive programs based on behavior, based on call reports, which in the old days would have been much dicier. We just finished an experiment with some farmer reps who put on incentive programs based on call reports. They were already getting incentives on sales, and adding incentives and call reports increased their sales even more. So that's some of the stuff that could not have been done 15 years ago because we didn't have the data. We have the data now, and it actually behooves all of us to exploit that data for business reasons, not just to produce pretty graphs.
Dr. John, you really taken the conversation in a whole different direction. You've given us all tremendous food for thought. A peek into the world of academia that a lot of us have been away from for many, many years. I want to thank you for stimulating our thoughts and desires and really giving us a lot to think about as we head into the balance of 2020 and look at 2021. Thank you very much, Dr. John. I'm going to turn it back over to Stephanie to wrap up.
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. John, for being on this episode of ERA Talks.
Thank you, Walt. Go Gophers.
It was so interesting, and you brought so much value to this topic. For those that are listening, be sure to check out ERA.org for more events, resources, and membership information. Chat soon.